Well, it's a privilege to be able to think about the way God worked in my life. And I want to begin with a biblical text. It's taken from 1 Corinthians chapter 4, where the Apostle Paul is describing what the Corinthians have received. And it's 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 7. The sentence, "What do you have that you did not receive?" When I look back at my life, one of the things that it plays a central role is books. I grew up in an environment where my father was a professor of electrical engineering, and books were very much a part of his life. And I think one of the deepest impressions made on me as a young child was my father reading books. I would later find out, years later, that my father never read anything outside of his field. So all he was poring over were books of electrical engineering. And I remember as the last, probably about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, we would give him occasionally books on other areas as Christmas presents. And finally, he broached the truth to us that, frankly, he said, "Michael, I never read any of these things." And so the bookish element in my life as a youngster had a very specific content. But I didn't know that. All I had was a father who regularly was immersed in books. My father was Kurdish, Muslim in his origins. He was born in Kirkuk in Iraq. Those are details that I didn't know when I was growing up. My mother and father led us to believe that he was Armenian in background, that he had a Christian heritage. She was Roman Catholic, Irish Roman Catholic. After the end of the Second World War, my father got a grant from the Iraqi government. The Iraqi government had had close ties with Britain ever since the First World War, when after the end of the First World War, the Treaty of Versailles, the British and the French carved up the Ottoman Empire. And if you look at a map of the Middle East, you'll notice the lines are very, very straight. And that's because of that carving up. And Iraq was given to the sovereignty, as it were, of Britain to oversee, as was Egypt. And France had Lebanon and Syria. And so there was this connection with Britain. And my father came when he was 16 or 17 to study at Birmingham University for a BA in BSc in electrical engineering. He would go on and do a master's and a doctorate there. While he was there, he met my mother, who was, she had come to England when she was about 16 to work at a chocolate factory, Cadbury's chocolate factory, which was established just outside of Birmingham. And if I understand correctly, they met at a dance. And my grandparents on my mother's side were not approving of the marriage. They basically ordered my mother, to go back home to Ireland. My father followed her. He converted to Roman Catholicism, and hence the importance that it always appeared to his children that he'd been raised in a Christian background. And they did subsequently marry, and I'm the eldest of their children. And growing up, then I was taken to a Roman Catholic church. It was pre-Vatican II. Roman Catholicism in those days was a Latin mass, what I would later come to describe as smells and bells. The mass was a very mysterious affair because you would go, the only thing in English you would hear would be the priest giving a small homily. My remembrances of those are simply him asking for money. And the rest of the mass obviously was in Latin. And you've got the atmosphere that the church would be filled with incense. And it's a very mysterious, exotic affair that I came to conclude by the time I was around probably 10 or 11 that this is something I go to on a Sunday. It's got nothing to do with my everyday life. I grew up in England, in Coventry, England, and went to a public school. But those were still the days when you would have assemblies where hymns would be sung. And one of the hymns that I remember singing that made a deep impression on me was "Onward, Christian Soldiers." It's not exactly politically correct in certain circles today. But I can remember that making a deep impression because when I was used to walk home from school in England during the winter months, night comes very quickly because of its position in terms of the hemisphere in the north. And it can be getting dark around 4:30, and As a young child, getting involved in football or soccer, I'd be walking home, maybe 5:30, 6, and there was a large open area I used to have to go by. And I would be gripped by deep fear, and I would sing Onward Christian Soldiers as a way of comforting myself to get myself through that. And it's interesting the seeds that God plants that bear fruit later on. In 1965, I just turned 12, my father got a position. He'd been a lecturer in the University of Warwick in England. In the British system of university education, in a faculty or in a department, there would only ever be one professor. It's very, very much a hierarchical system. You would have lecturers, readers below that or above that. And you normally didn't get a professorship until you were in your 50s. Here in North America, it's quite different. And my father was offered a professorship, a full professorship with tenure when he was around 33, 34 at McMaster University in Hamilton, which was at one point a full Baptist institution. The only part that was Baptist when my father came was the Divinity College, but it had once been owned by the Baptists. And so it was, we moved to Canada. Growing up in, just one further thing I think that's important, because when you think of the one's epistemological journey or intellectual journey, there are a variety of things that come to play, not simply that which we necessarily call strictly intellectual. There's an affective element or a psychological element. And while I had a very good relationship with my mother, my father growing up was very distant. He was, as I would later realize, a workaholic. And some of that was born out of his coming to England and experiencing deep discrimination. He was a Kurd. The Kurdish situation, which I'm sure you're familiar with, is one in which they have been oppressed by the Arabs. There is a difference there of ethnicity. The Arabs are obviously a Semitic people. The Kurds are Indo-European. They're akin to the Iranians and would be part of that large block of Indo-European migration that came into Europe in the probably the third millennium B.C. And the Kurds have a deep hatred of the Arabs. And my father would be mistaken for an Arab. In fact, I remember growing up being the butt of racial discrimination because I didn't fit in. I had black hair, but if I'd had black hair and blue eyes, it would have been fine because then I would have been Celtic. Either Welsh or some certain Irish, but I had black hair and brown eyes, which set me apart. And my father, I think, poured himself into his work to prove himself. I don't know that. My father is still living, and he doesn't talk about his past. There are a lot of emotional hurts, I think, there. The other point that is important, I think, in my father's story is that, and that has an impact on me, is that when he became a Catholic, his family cut him off and he cut them off. And so there was no contact with any on his side of the family. And so I grew up very much in an immersion in an Irish Catholic background. I didn't know that at the time. We were living in England, but it was very Irish. There was a large Irish population that had come over to England at various points of time, and they were living in Birmingham, and many of my mother's relatives were there, and it was very typically Irish, the superstitions, etc. So we came to Canada in 1965. It was an excellent opportunity for my father. He got full professorship tenure as a professor of electrical engineering at McMaster University. Coming to Canada, the English educational system for children is very different from North America. And it used to be, it's not this way anymore, but at 11 years old, you would take an exam called the 11 Plus in England. And essentially, that determined, that they've changed this now, it was very much part of a hierarchical system, but that determined whether or not you'd ever go to university. Because your score in that exam determined whether you go to a vocational school, which would end around what we would describe as grade 12, and then you'd be shunted into the workforce, or you'd go to a grammar school, which would open the way to university. So when my father came to Canada, I was in a grammar school. I'd started things like Latin. I'd been doing French. He took me up to high school, and I just turned 12. So he took me up and said to the people that he didn't understand the system. He said, "Well, do you think you can admit him to grade 9? And so it was. I was admitted to grade 9. I just turned 12. Again, in those days, in the high school I was in, they streamed the various students. Some students who were into music would be in 9A, class 9A, 9B, etc. I was in 9E, and 9E was a class for students, a good number of whom had failed 2 or 3 times. At least it seemed that to me. Because I'm in there with guys who are 15, 16 years old, and I'm 12. And I'm going home to play with G.I. Joe, and they're talking about dating and drinking. And the importance of that for me was that I'm still going to the Catholic Church, taken by my parents to the Catholic Church. And I knew what these guys were like. Many of them were Catholic. I'd know what they talk about during the week, and then I'd see them going up getting the Mass. And I thought, this is just pure hypocrisy. Chiming in with that was my relationship with my father. My father and I did not have a good relationship when I was growing up. The only times I can remember him were times when he had to exercise authority in my life. And so issues of authority and obedience were very thorny issues to me. And I didn't like authority figures. You put that mix, given that background, being brought from England, I found myself in a difficult environment. My accent, which I probably learned pretty quickly to slough off, I was called matey or mate by certain students. One student used to regularly call me Arab and experienced something. And I think this is important looking back, is why I had sympathy for the Black Panthers, was because of that experience of racism to some degree. And you put that kind of context together. I didn't have any friends in my grade 9 or 10. It was not until really I got to grade 12 that I started to get some close friends. And they were guys in grade 9 and 10 because they're my age. You put all that together, then you put it into the volatile environment of the late 1960s. And in the late 1960s, as I'm sure you're all aware, there emerged a generation that was deeply distrustful of authority and deeply convinced that there had to be radical change in the structures of Western culture and society. And I got caught up in all of that. Teenagers are deeply impressed by figures, be they what they are. And in that day, the figures who came into my life were people like Che Guevara. Guevara was killed in 67, so he was still living at the point when I started to read him. Mao Zedong, some of the atrocities that were going on in Mao's China were not that well known in the West at that point in time. Obviously, the Black Panthers, the figure who I remember most clearly was Eldred Cleaver, the book Soul on Ice, which has some deep problems. It's not merely a statement of Marxist ideology wanting to restructure a society, but also has major ethical issues. He argues for the propriety of raping white women as a way of getting back at white culture in that book. I didn't remember that at the time. I just imbibed some of the rhetoric and the desire for radical change. And it wasn't simply peaceful change, it was radical change. So that by the time I was probably 1968, I was intellectually committed to violent revolution. A very important book, I think, for me was Herbert Marcuse's One Dimensional Man, in which Marcuse uses Marxist analysis to describe the alienation that had occurred in Western culture as a result of technological advance. And that just chimed in with my own existential experience. I was still suffering, I think, or wrestling with the alienation I experienced coming across from England, the strangeness of the culture, my own alienation with my family existentially. And here was a philosophical analysis of that that also called for radical change in the culture. And through my high school years, then I eventually repeated grade 13. We had five grades in high school. We had you go up to grade 12. They also had a grade 13. They've since dispensed with that. I repeated that. So I did 6 years in high school because I didn't want to go to university and have the same experience that I had when I had come to high school. By the end of that high school experience, I was a doctrinaire Marxist, radically committed to a violent revolution along the styles of Che Guevara. Guevara's break with Castro, if I recall correctly, and there probably were others, had to do with the issue of whether or not the revolution had to be a perpetual thing going on in a culture. And I was committed to kind of a perpetual revolution, which really would have resulted in a state of anarchy. Well, it's one thing to be a kind of budding Marxist, doctrinaire revolutionary, in your parents' home, you're living in a bourgeois, quote-unquote, existence, enjoying all of that. And meanwhile, you're talking about subverting the culture. It's hypocrisy. And that bubble was burst when I went away to university. I went to University of Western Ontario, which is in London, and in the pursuit of a history degree, I'd always loved history, and for a few years I got, no offense, sidetracked into philosophy. And that would prove to be very providential. But how I ended up at Western, I still don't know to this day. I'd wanted to go to either the University of Toronto, where I did end up, or the University of Queen's, which had a very good history program, which is in Kingston, Ontario, where on both of those universities, I had friends who went there. I didn't have any friends at the University of Western Ontario. And because I hadn't put the choice in at first place in my listing of universities to go to, I didn't get an option of residence. And so my parents had to take me down, find me a home to rent, live in. And I was living with a very elderly couple in their 80s. And they'd often had students take a room, and they'd give them breakfast or whatever, and it was in walking distance university. They were often talking about, this is my memory, of friends who died. They're in their 80s. They've got a lot of friends who are dying. And suddenly I was confronted with a question that went beyond the political questions. The questions I had assumed were the most important were political questions, that the problems with myself, with culture in general, the alienation. All of this, again, by the way, is against the backdrop of the Vietnam War. I would be firmly anti-Vietnam. All of these questions now seem to pale into insignificance because I realized that one day I would die. And I began to think about Marxism as what kind of answers it had for that. And it had none. It simply had none. The longing for, in Marxist ideology, you're going to have a series of economic change until you get to that classless state where the proletariat, the workers, take over. And there is this kind of utopia on earth. It actually fits, I think, within a Christian framework. I don't think you could have had the rise of Marxism without a Christian background. But it's a secularized version of heaven. But it really doesn't speak to the issue of death. I mean, I could talk about dying for the revolution, but what did that mean after I was dead? And I was taking a philosophy course, and in the course of the philosophy, it was an intro to philosophy, so you did metaphysics, ethics, aesthetics, etc. In the section on ethics, we were to read a variety of papers and comment essays, do essays on them, and the one that I chose to read was one by a man named C.S. Lewis. Never heard of him. The essay was Right and Wrong as a Clue to the Meaning of the Universe. And as I worked through that, I disagreed with Lewis. I didn't think he was right, that there was this instinctive right sense of right and wrong in every human being. But there was enough of the idealist in me to recognize that there was something here beyond what I'd ever really thought about. In the fall of September of 1971, I had another experience which was, I think, very formative. And it was one that was non-discursive. It didn't come through ways of reasoning, and I remember sitting down in my room and wanting to put down on paper a proof for the existence of God or the non-existence of God. During my years as a Marxist, although I should have been a committed atheist, I probably could be best described as an agnostic. And I remember sitting down, and before I could put pen to paper, I just knew there was a God. It was overwhelming. It was frightening. I remember leaping up and running out of the room. I was terrified about the idea, but I knew that there was a God. That year also was the year that I first met Christians in any real measure. I didn't have any friends at Western except for one man who I played football with in high school, American football. His name was Doug McMillan. And I'd always looked up to Dougie. Dougie was cool. His long hair was always in the right shape. And he was just a great linebacker. He was an interior linebacker. He used to blitz. You won't believe this, I used to play offensive guard. We used to pull our guards a lot to do sweeps around the end. And I always wanted to play interior linebacker. I mean, Dougie was so cool. He'd come blitzing through and take out the quarterback. And I really looked up to Doug and found out he was on campus and made a number of opportunities to meet with him. I took a number of opportunities to meet with him. He had met Christians. He had actually become a Christian. And so I'd listen to these people talking about Jesus and being filled with the Spirit. I was now interested in God, but not Christianity. And there was that long, in my own personal history, that long association of Christianity with hypocrisy and Roman Catholicism. And I didn't want anything to do with it. And again, my story in so many ways is typical of a 1960s person. Commitment to a radical left. The failure of that politically, and then the transition into some sort of spiritual search, which never really considered Christianity, but got into things like TM. I was into TM for a while, Transcendental Meditation. I had a great love for the Beatles, and they're flirting with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and his TM. He was a complete hoax in many respects. George Harrison was my favorite Beatle, and as you know, he became a follower of Krishna, and so that had a lingering, obviously, impact on me. Zen Buddhism, I was reading Zen Buddhism. Zen Buddhism is classically atheistic, but it has a spiritual dimension. Taoism, in other words, a variety of Eastern religions. But my loneliness finally overcame me, and in the second year of university, fall of 1972, I transferred to the University of Toronto, where I had two friends, two of my closest friends who I'd grown up in high school. And both of them had been committed to a Marxist revolution, at least I thought they were. And we lived in a one-bedroom apartment, three guys in one bedroom. By the end of the year, none of us were speaking to each other. Well, at least I wasn't speaking to them, they weren't speaking to me. Part of my problem was this. I remember one time, one of my friends coming home, and I didn't realize. For me, the commitment to the left was a way of dispensing with ethnic difference, and I was very committed to a situation where people were not judged on their ethnicity, and that I think because of my own experience. And I remember the horror coming home one day, and one of my friends said to me, "You know, there is a major tower in the heart of the University of Toronto called Soldiers Tower. It commemorates the men who died in the First and Second World War." He said, "I could go up that with a scope, and I could take out all the Jews." I'm looking at it. What on earth are you talking about? Well, you see, they wear the yarmulke. There were a lot of Jewish on the campus at Toronto. And I suddenly realized, here's one of my closest friends. I don't even know this guy. Something that was so deeply ingrained in me about the importance of overlooking ethnic differences, I thought he was with me with that. And I began to be alienated from these two friends. And by the end of the year, I had fallen back into a lifestyle I had followed in my latter years of university, which was heavy drinking, basically used up all my money getting drunk on weekends. Most of my friends were deeply into the drug culture. I'm very thankful to God that God spared me that. Most of my friends were acid heads and saw drugs as a political act of disobedience to the state, and I'm very thankful God spared me that. And drinking on weekends, and but by the end of that year, I was no longer friends with them. I was going to come back for a third year. I was doing my BA in philosophy and realized I'd had to live by myself. Philosophically, I'm very interested in God, but philosophically, I'm reading heavily in existentialism. And existentialism probably was the philosophical philosophy of choice in the late 60s and 70s. I never was attracted to Sartre. Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist, I felt he was simply a man of letters. I didn't really think he had much philosophically to say. Soren Kierkegaard was a favorite. Reading Kierkegaard, I was immersing myself, again, in a Christian environment. I didn't see that. Probably the book that made most impact on me was his book, which is an analysis of Genesis 22, Fear and Trembling, and God's command to Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. But the key philosopher that I was reading was Martin Heidegger, who died in the 70s. And I had a professor who was a Heideggerian. He'd studied under Heidegger in Germany. Heidegger since has come under some cloud because of his associations with the Nazi Party during the 1930s, 1940s, which he's tried to explain probably inadequately. Heidegger was important for me for a variety of reasons, and you'll excuse if I look at some notes here that I made as I wanted to kind of make sure I got everything in terms of how Heidegger was important to me. I was reading, actually I asked this professor, I had an encounter with Heidegger in one of my classes, and then I asked this man, Professor Morrison, who was a Heideggerian, could I do a reading course with him on the book Sein und Zeit, Being in Time, published in the 20s, English translation in the 1960s. And reading Heidegger is like learning to read a foreign language. He makes up meanings for words and coins words. And I remember showing some of his German to a German speaker, and the guy had no idea what he was talking about. And I started to realize, man, what am I into? There were probably five areas that were important for me in reading Heidegger. First of all, his critique of Western thought. I was fed up with Western culture. I thought Western culture had come to an impasse because of its way it had alienated men and women like myself. And I saw that as rooted deeply in the whole progress of Western culture and tied in with technological development. And Heidegger is critical of Western culture. In fact, he says the whole thing began to go wrong with Plato. If you go back to, you got to go back to the pre-Socratics. His favorite is Heraclitus, Parmenides. These were men who knew how to live philosophy as a way of life. And the wrong turn is taken with Plato. And that chimed in with my own thinking that there's something deeply wrong with the West. Secondly, Heidegger believed and argued that the experience of truth was very important for him, aletheia, that it comes to you in a non-discursive way. It comes suddenly. There's a sudden inrush of realization of what truth is. And that, again, chimed in with my own experience of God, how I had come to realize that there is a God. It was non-discursive. It was not through a process of rational reasoning. It was simply a revelation to me. And that, again, chimed in with my own experience. Thirdly, Heidegger spoke, I don't know how many other people he spoke to in the 60s. He spoke to me because of his demand for authenticity. There was language in the 60s like plastic. I mean, as I thought about the culture of the 1950s here in North America, it was plastic culture. It was, as Herbert Marcuse said, one-dimensional. There was an emphasis on uniformity. Men wore the same dress to work, the dark suit, the white tie, the white shirt. One of my delights in the 60s was wearing pink shirts, and nobody would ever wear things like that in the 50s. And there was this kind of thinking about the 50s in every area. It was so committed to uniformity, and the 60s was committed to being yourself, let it all hang out. That sort of terminology. And now Heidegger, he's a guy from the early, philosophically, early 20th century in many respects, but he talks about the importance of living authentic life. And that's what I wanted. I wanted an authentic life that was marked by transparency. There's another critical word in there, which I think the generation of the 60s failed, was that authentic life has to be a life of integrity. What I didn't realize is that much of the authenticity was simply a way of expressing self, etc. And then for Heidegger, philosophy was a way of life. It consumed her entire being. And one of my failings is I tend to be a person of extremes. I'm either this and against all that, or I'm that and against all this. And that just, again, resonated with who I was. I wanted to give myself passionately to something. I can remember a discussion in my late teens before I went to university with some friends. Is there something we would die for? And fifthly, Heidegger reintroduced, I think, to Western English-speaking philosophical thought a passion for metaphysics and ontology, dealing with questions of existence and being, where most Western philosophers, English-speaking philosophers, were wrapped up in questions of philosophy of language. Guys like A.J. Ayer and Bertrand Russell, you can't even talk about God and the meaning of life because the whole language is so deeply flawed. Those questions have they're meaningless. But there was a hunger, at least in my soul, to have answers to those questions. And it didn't satisfy me. These characters claim to be philosophers saying, well, all these questions are completely out of bounds. Heidegger brought those questions for me back into the foreground because he was primarily concerned with ontology and metaphysics. What I didn't realize, and I realized only later as I became a Christian, that I wasn't reading Heidegger completely. Heidegger talks about truth manifesting itself in what he calls Dasein, being there. I thought for Heidegger, Dasein was God, and it actually wasn't. Heidegger's whole construct, the early Heidegger, was to think philosophically without reference to theology at all. The later Heidegger realized the failure of that and began to move in mystical directions. But I didn't realize that. And I thought Heidegger was passionately seeking the holy, as I was. The summer of 1973, at the end of that academic year in which I ended up in the second year at university, not speaking with these two friends, I was working in Hamilton. I got a job in a pizza parlor, Mother's Pizza. Don't expect you to know it. It was an important chain of pizzas in Canada for a while. And I'd had two experiences that early summer. One of them was one time I was a smoker. Again, smoking was a way of making a political statement. And I used to roll my own. I didn't want any filter. And I just remember one time just being disgusted with it. The whole feeling of disgust, and I threw it away. And I've never smoked since. And then I'd never had a hangover. Any of the times I'd be drunk, I'd never had a hangover. This one time I had a hangover. I thought, man, if this is what might happen again, I don't want any part of this either. I'm not a Christian. But I look back, I see God working in my life. Because that summer I met a young Christian woman who became my wife. I cut my hair. My hair, I always wanted to grow long. It just kind of grew out. And I cut my hair, stopped drinking, stopped smoking, which were important because the woman I met was Baptist. She wouldn't have looked at me. She would have crossed the other side of the street. And she was hired as the cashier at this pizza establishment, and I was the pizza maker. And we used to one shift that we used to work together, two shifts, was a Friday and Saturday night. You'd come in at 5 o'clock, and you'd work through till 2. It actually meant working through till about 4, because 5 o'clock, you get all the families come in and have pizza. About 11 or 12, all the university students would hit the place, because McMaster University was about 5 minutes walk. And then there was a pub nearby called Paddy Green's. And Paddy Green's would close at 1 at night, at least on the Friday, and all the pubbers would come out for pizza. And so I'd be making the pizzas, and she was right here. And what attracted to me her initially was her red hair. My mother had red hair, and I've always loved red hair. And I was actually quite smitten with her. And I found out she went to church. And I wanted to clean my life up. And I'm thinking like a Catholic, you know, you do the external kind of stuff. And so I asked her, can I go to church with you? And that obviously led to a relationship with her. I was speaking with her, finding out about her faith. And she went to an evangelical Baptist church. It was a Fellowship Baptist church in Canada. The Baptists, it's a bit like the GARB, if you know the General Association of Regular Baptists. The history is very similar. The ethos is very similar. And I was a pretty fast talker about God, but I was not prepared for what I experienced there. I had some problems. I had problems with the worship. It didn't look like worship. And I couldn't figure out why people would go up and do the solos, you know, singing a solo. Is this Hollywood, or are we supposed to clap after this? And it didn't. All I had was pre-Vatican II. Remember that pre-Vatican II Roman Catholic worship to kind of tie it back to it. This didn't look like that. I had problems with Baptists' lack of their sense of history. I'm passionate about history. And, who are you? Like, where did Baptists come from? We're New Testament people, people of the book, you know? I had this impression these people, you know, neither cared, and they had no idea, and they didn't really care either. But it wasn't those things that disturbed me most. It was God. My wife's family have the disturbing, unbaptistic habit of sitting right in the front row. I attribute this to the fact she was raised Presbyterian and her mother was Presbyterian. And I tend to think, I haven't been in many Presbyterian worship services, so I'm tending to think that Presbyterians all love the front row, like unlike Baptists who love the back row. And they'd go right down the front, and I'd be squished in there between her brothers and her mother and her, and I'd be right in the dead center, right under the preacher, and it just was very uncomfortable. I'd be fine before I went to church, and then I'd get to church, and I'd be terrified. It's very difficult. I remember the feelings, but it's very difficult to conjure them up now, just the feeling of terror. I knew something of this intellectually because of Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling. But I'd never experienced it existentially. The man who was the preacher was a man named Bruce Woods, and he had experienced in his ministry a touch of revival. He was linked with a group known as the Cetera Twins. You don't necessarily need to know who they are. They had been asked to preach at a church in 1970 in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Ebenezer Baptist Church, a man named Bill McLeod. And God had moved there in a remarkable way. They had been invited to come for a week of meetings. They stayed for 6 weeks. And they moved out of the church to a huge hall. The place was crowded. There were conversions galore. People were restored, making restitution, you know, returning stolen goods. It was just a remarkable move. He was impacted by that. And there was a presence in his preaching that I couldn't fathom. My great fear, as the fall of 1973 began, that reemerged. I was now by myself during the week back in Toronto, living in a bachelor apartment, about 15 minutes from the university. My great fear was fear of death. It came back. It was compounded by the fact that Martin Heidegger, one other area of Heidegger's thought, is that to live an authentic life, you must contemplate your death. It's life towards death, always. Well, this didn't help me, because I've got this deep fear of death. But now there's a solution at hand, because I'm hearing about one who's overcome death. And it was the weight of truth as I heard the preaching of the resurrection and the cross that started to bear down on me. And the crisis point came in February of 74. And there was a man named Elwin Davies was invited to preach. And I'm not sure of his career. I remember the name. I've looked the name up since then. There are two Elwin Davies of that era. One was in Wales. It couldn't have been him. It was a North American Elwin Davies. And he gave an altar call. at the end of a sermon. And it was somewhere in the February of 74, third week, I think. And it wasn't one of these belabored altar calls. You know, I know there's someone out there who needs to come forward. We'll sing one more time, the chorus. Now, there was like 35 people at the front, and I was one of them. I'm not sure if that was my conversion or whether it was later in the week. I went back to university that week and woke up three nights running, absolutely terrified. And the third night, thinking, I just can't do this studying away from Allison, who became my wife, away from my home. And I'm going to pack it all in. I'm going to go back to Hamilton, where I lived, and become a pizza maker the rest of my life. And I found myself on my knees crying out to God to save me. And I think that is the moment of my conversion. There was a sense of, within a very short period of time, of a call to ministry. I did a foolish thing. Reading Colossians, I hit those passages that talk about the vain philosophy. And I got rid of all my books, my philosophy books. I've deeply regretted that since. Especially when I was asked to teach philosophy at the college level. And first philosophy of religion, and then Western philosophy, history of Western thought. Man, I wish I had all those books. But just a word and caution, don't burn those bridges. And there's the work, the transformation, obviously, was there was a moving from life, from death to life, from spiritual darkness into light. But there are perspectives that didn't change overnight. There are three political parties, for example, in Canada. There's the Conservative Party, similar to the Republicans. There's the Liberal Party, similar to the Democrats. And then there's the NDP, New Democratic Party, who are socialists, who are on the wing, probably left-wing Republican. And I voted NDP for probably 5 to 7 years after my conversion. And because they had a commitment to social policies that still hark back to some of my Marxist days. Eventually, God showed me I had to prioritize their commitment to abortion and homosexual agenda started to make me realize I couldn't vote in good conscience for these people. And so there is a conversion doesn't bring about immediate intellectual transformation, but there's been a growing into what accords, I think, with truth.